the first part of an interview with General Marshall on November the 15th, 1956.
My first answer refers to 11, question 1, regarding Mr. Churchill's feelings as to the Greek islands and our attitude towards the Eastern Mediterranean and General Eisenhower's attitude. In the first place, as I think I told you yesterday, he acted in regard to these Greek islands without any regard to the Combined Chiefs of Staff, which was highly irregular. And it followed immediately on his recovery from his convalescence from pneumonia and my action in proposing the Americans release the executive control in the Mediterranean. So to put it very frankly, it was in poor taste to say the least. And I'm not very sympathetic to his feeling deeply about it. Later, the question of the Isle of Rhodes came up, in which we had to oppose him very strongly. In all these matters, it was very difficult. In dealing with the British Chiefs of Staff, to tell whether we were really dealing directly with Mr. Churchill or with their opinion. Their position, I think, was extraordinarily difficult. Mr. Churchill was very intense when he got a certain idea, and he did business with them every day, whereas sometimes I didn't see the president for a month. So our trouble was to know just when we were encountering Mr. Churchill's opinion or when it was the British Chiefs of Staff opinion. Now in this Eastern Mediterranean question, he directed action there, which as I say was highly irregular, because we were never consulted, which we had every right to be. And therefore, he is without position when he feels we didn't back him up. Now, as to General Eisenhower's feeling about diverting forces from Italy for these activities, and the U.S. Chiefs of Staff backing him, this is the same thing. We were resisting constant efforts to diminish the setup or the time element for cross-channel operation. I've forgotten the technical name for it.
Overlord.
Now turning to chapter 11, question 2. I don't know about the answer to 2. And in a way, I've forgotten just what conversations took place in the USCIS staff and with me, with the planners, and by me, with the planners. The suggestion, question three, the suggestion about General Morgan is correct. I had in mind, starting off with him, at least during the preliminary stage as Chief of Staff, just what my action would have been in the effort to keep matters composed when I found that the principal British leader was violently, almost vindictively opposed to him. I'm not prepared to say.
I believe you've answered part of those questions. Let me just see those things. I think you handed me these and I gave them back to you. Yeah. You've answered these down here. You handed them to me yesterday.
And then the next one is...
12.
12. Chapter 12, question 1. With reference to Tehran. I have forgotten the details regarding the occupation zones. I know we had rather lengthy discussions with the President. They found him very fixed in his position, and as I recall, McCloy played a leading part in this.
At any rate, you had nothing to do with drawing those lines. You personally, yes.
No, I had nothing to do with these initial proposal of these lines. It came from London, I believe. The feelings at the time were rather involved. McCloy wanted one thing in which we backed him, and the President wanted quite another, and in the background was what would the French get? And on this phase, the President was either very sketchy or antagonistic. I don't recall the President giving me a paper. I presume he did, and I don't recall the paper. But in all these occupation zone matters, in the back of our heads, I say our, certainly in mine, was the prospect that we would be rather remote from Berlin at the time the Russians got there. Of course, it didn't work out that way. The rapid occupation of the Ruhr, and also the evident desire of the Germans to surrender to the Allies, completely changed the military setup at the finish. And incidentally, I might say that that conquest of the Ruhr and the fighting immediately following it was really a magnificent performance, because it was a running battle that General Bradley was conducting, with the necessity at the same time of taking care of a moving German population. I remember they were reporting to me at one place there were 20,000 moving Germans in charge of one corporal who organized the entire affair, fed them, and managed everything, which was a typical American procedure. And this corporal evidently had very fine judgment and was not seeking publicity.
Yeah.
Did you find any record of that when you were working on the thing over there?
Not that particular episode, but I have seen just enormous numbers of people coming back under practically no guard at all. I went through to the south of the Ruhr, so I didn't get in on it, on that part.
Well, do you want me to tell a story about that sort of
yes,
thing now?
Yes, certainly.
After the battle in Tunisia and the surrender of the Italian Rommel forces, I found myself visiting in an olive grove where a battalion, I think of the 34th Infantry, was bivouacked following the battle. And this was on a portion of the battleground. And it happened to be Decoration Day. So they planned a ceremony for which they asked me to delay my departure in order that I might witness it. So a couple of hours later, in the late afternoon, I went with the division commander, General Ryder, out on a field where the troops were assembled. The ceremony was conducted by the chaplain. His remarks were largely a repetition of the order for that day, which was a historical reminder of how the Decoration Day affair was organized shortly after the Civil War. So his remarks were not very interesting. But more to the point was the fact that when it came to the singing, he distributed some books, but they had no leaders, and he led, and he was tone deaf. And they started to try to sing with him, but they quit. And it was a very agonizingly pathetic performance. Added to which, the men were in deep column, so only a few were close enough to hear anything. And above all, they were facing the setting sun, and it was square in their eyes. And it was not a cool day. Now, I had issued an order against the advice of the chief of chaplains, Bishop Arnold, charging commanders with the same responsibility for the conduct of the chaplain as a regimental or battalion commander had for the training of his unit. We were not interested in the, what do you call a religion, the
denominational,
we were not interested in the denominational matters or the religious procedures, but intensely interested in the effectiveness of the chaplain. Was he carrying his wheat? Or was he more or less innocuous? Well, Bishop Arnold was very doubtful about this, particularly as he was the presiding judge, in effect. However, I went ahead with it. So this particular chaplain in Tunisia came to my forcible attention on account of the miserable procedure. While the ceremony was going on, I taxed General Ryder with this state of affairs, and he replied by saying this was a battalion chaplain and they had a perfectly splendid division chaplain. And I replied I was not talking about the division chaplain, I was talking about this battalion, which was his battalion, and that chaplain. He again tried to tell me about the division chaplain, and I refused to hear. At the end of the ceremony, I took over and faced the men away from the setting sun and had them sit down, and then gave them a talk describing what was going on with the American forces in various portions of the world, trying to take the curse off part of this miscast ceremony. And when we got in the car to leave, General Ryder asked my permission to tell me about this division chaplain. Well, I said, all right, you tell me, but don't forget this battalion chaplain to tell him. He said the division chaplain drove up there in an open Cadillac at the time of the surrendering of the troops. And on this plane right out there by us were thousands of prisoners who had just surrendered themselves. They were moving in from every direction. And as a matter of fact, in some places, the Germans were controlling the movements, just automatically taking control. Our fellows were busy fighting at some other point. This chaplain came up in his car, and a German major attacked him on the failure of the Americans to organize this affair, leaving it to the Germans, and was very, very caustic and exceedingly arrogant. The chaplain explained that they didn't have any experience in this, and they'd probably do it better the next time, implying in a gentle way there would be a next time, which went over the arrogant German's head, and he held forth again, infuriating the corporal, who was particularly irritated that the chaplain was so mild. But this time the chaplain pointed to the caduces and he said, do you know what these are? And the German said he didn't know at all what they were, but he didn't see any relation to this situation. Well, the chaplain says, that means that I'm a chaplain. I have nothing to do with this affair at all. He said, as a matter of fact, I came over here to plant one of you bastards. So the corporal cheered from the driver's seat. Now, when I returned to Algiers that night, or the next morning, I've forgotten which, just in time to come back, to return again with Mr. Churchill, who had been busy with a submarine flotilla, I told the story to Mr. Churchill, and he was much amused. But the next day, after the review of all the troops, the victory parade, as it were, he said to me, he said, you got that story wrong. I said, was General Ryder telling it to you? And he said, yes. Well, I said, what is wrong with it? Well, he said, you said bury that bastard and said to just plant that bastard.
No, he'd heard the same story.
he got on the word right away. Plant was very much better.
He had a good ear for the proper language.
Oh, yes.
I don't suppose there's been anyone in our time that
Oh, no, he's the great master with terminology, I guess you'd put it.
Wilson was probably our closest man to him.
Who?
Wilson in this country
oh,
was
yes.
probably his closest.
Yes, he was. But the trouble with Mr. Wilson, I would say, by comparison, was his was very perfect English, but it didn't arouse you.
Uh-huh.
And Churchill's was calculated to put everybody on their feet. In fact, he defended England at its weakest point by his statements.
Yes.
He rallied the whole nation.
Oh, it was magnificent. Like that, some chicken, some neck, you know, they're going to wring our necks.
Question two on the race to Berlin. I don't recall. In detail, such conversation. And it would seem to me now, looking at it, that the president was probably anticipating the surrender before the actual fall of Berlin. In that case, we'd be free to approach without resistance, and it might be a race between the Soviets and ourselves.
And in case we got there first, we would take it.
Well, I didn't get that.
You didn't get that.
Specifically, one way or the other.
I think it's possible that that statement may be put down wrong in the record.
Yeah.
Because it's contradictory as it stands, where on the one hand, you know, you've said that he's told you that he wanted it to be shared by the four, and then it says later the United States should have it.
I don't recall the discussions regarding Austria. And any area of the Balkans. As to the joint occupation of Berlin, meaning, I presume,
four power occupation.
Hmm?
Four power occupation.
Yes, the four power occupation. In effect favored that, I would say, because it was in effect on our hands, except as to the French. And there we had a battle, because the Soviets were utterly contemptuous of the French. And there still were, as a matter of fact, when I went to Moscow as Secretary of State. And Bido was very much insulted by the way they treated him, when he was actually my senior by time, and by rank, because he was the
foreign minister.
He was the prime minister. And in the seating and all, they deferred to me.
However, you shared to some extent the president's fear of a long time occupation, didn't you?
Yes.
Overseas, because you knew how the American public reacted to those things.
Yes. We were worried about that all the time. And I was worried by something I referred to a good many times to my staff, and which they didn't understand at all because they'd never been through it, which was the change of public opinion, not only as to the time factor, but as to attitudes. I'd seen that so clearly marked in the Philippines, when there was a most friendly relationship between the troops, our troops, and the surrendering insurgents, including who was the president of the Philippines?
Quezon.
Hmm?
Quezon.
Quezon. But as soon as it passed more or less into a civilian control, it awakened all sorts of bitterness. Hmm. And the feelings that were dominating action in Europe, I felt certain, would be modified, just as Mr. Roosevelt's frequent reference to feeding the Germans for years from soup kitchens and giving them nothing else. And I might say that a good many of my embarrassments as Secretary of State flowed from the fact that we'd gotten into these things in this revengeful or vicious mood, and now we were trying to get out of them, which made our negotiations as pertains to the Soviets very difficult on our changing attitude. That was particularly the case in relation to Japan. As evidence of the bitterness and illogic of the feelings, one of our commanders, I've forgotten his name right now, but he was a very gallant fighter, was bitterly attacked, I think before Congress, certainly in the American press, because he had a meal with a surrendering Russian, surrendering German. Things were just absurd, you know.
I know it got so bad that you had to send General Eisenhower a message saying, be careful with this sort of thing.
They didn't understand what was going on, you see.
Well, as I pointed out in the chapter in this book I helped write on Yalta, Mr. Roosevelt and Churchill were captives to an extent of the feeling they'd helped work up in order to get
yes.
unity against the Germans.
Yes.
And you can't undo it the moment.
Well, it's the same thing with de Gaulle. They worked up a great feeling about de Gaulle in England, in which Eden played quite a part. Now they had him on their hands, and they couldn't unblock. Well, that business about Japan was very striking. General Frank McCoy was chairman of that Russian-American committee they had. And he got a Russian agreement on a lot of these things, but we changed our policy. Then we call on him to change it with them. Well, of course, it was quite another matter then.
All the Russians had to do was to
then they began criticizing General McCoy, and as I came in as Secretary of State, he was under criticism. And when I looked into the thing, I found that anything to be under criticism was the State Department.
Sure.
But it was American changing feelings. Here they were trying, now they were violent against Japan, and properly so. Now, but they got their regulations based on violence, which is a feeling, which is always bad. And now they have to change them around because they found the apparent enemy was going to be the Soviets
yeah.
and not Japan. In other words, she wouldn't be a feared possible
yeah.
opponent.
In question three, I've gone beyond 1943 to 45, but it seemed a logical place to ask this.
I don't recall about question three as to the final responsibility. these things became so highly political at that time.
General Clay finally said he supposed it was his responsibility that he should have looked into it.
Who?
General Clay. Lucius Clay.
Oh, he was there, wasn't he?
Yes, sir. But I think that just nobody thought of it.
Of course, in the long period, a lot of these things we weren't concerned with at all at the time, and then afterwards, historically, they become very important.
And the danger is that people read back things into it that weren't there. Yeah.
People would not be interested in reading, but I think it'd be very important in any book covering a war of a long period to ever so often resume the status of public opinion at the time. Now, you take lots of our negotiations. Well, you can't negotiate without any strength at all. You don't walk up and slap a man in the face if you haven't got any way of protecting yourself. You may feel the thing, but you've got to be very judicious about it. As you become strong, your attitude can be quite different. Now, that was very much the case in relation to the Soviets, apropos Korea. We just had nothing there at one time. And we were speaking without backing. We couldn't get enough. MacArthur was having to put men into battle of Korean birth with only 3 or 4 weeks training. We were taking over a year to get a division, and he was making those divisions in 30 days. While we were speaking from weakness, and it has to be judged in that relationship. When we got to, as the strength developed, which was about 1952, not before that, about 1952, real strength began to develop. Then our attitude towards the Soviet could be very much more frankly stated publicly, or certainly privately, because we were acquiring great power. Whereas before that, we just had literally none. In 50 and 51, the time it got to 53 and 54, we were a very powerful country.
But that's the case, for example, with Neville Chamberlain and his appeasement policy. He just didn't have any strength back at Munich, did he?
No, they didn't have anything. And we tried not to appease, but just to go easy.
Yeah.
We didn't attack. We were playing for time all the time. But there's a great difference in the way you talk, if you've got any wisdom at all, when you have nothing. And straight appeasement is unfortunate. But I think there should be brief resumes of the state of public opinion at various stages. You take the state of public opinion just at the time they almost legislated our army out of existence. They only saved it for one vote. I find people have forgotten all about that.
Yeah.
They've forgotten all about it. Mr. Rousseau's problem with the Middle West.
Yeah.
The Bible Belt and all those things. Very, very difficult. And you couldn't handle that at all the way you might have 2 years later.
That was only 2 or 3 months before Pearl Harbor, wasn't it?
Yes. That was the end of August. Pearl Harbor was the 7th of December. That was just like Congress cutting me down on the Appropriations Committee to 57 planes for the next year. And I only asked for $11 million for Alaska, which was just to get sheltered anchorage so that we could begin to defend 1,200 miles of the Aleutian Peninsula and all of that country, everything being very expensive to do, and this was but 11 millions, and they cut all that out, and that was just a few weeks before the fall of Paris.
Well, the fall of Paris is what woke people up here, wasn't it?
Yeah, but we had a terrible time before
this.
Poitiers. And I might add there that just prior to that, in the spring there, Hitler would do certain things, and I would always try to take advantage of what he did to get something out of Congress. It was very difficult for a long time there to get beyond the budget control, because the president was having a struggle with the debt limits and matters of that kind. And he returned from a fishing trip on the ill-fated Houston and landed in Miami. And earlier in the spring, I'd had the approval of the Budget Bureau for one sum of 28 millions, I think, the large portion of which was to be for the building up of the detection equipment and all for the western coast against any Japanese naval approach. I've forgotten. One was 18 millions and the other was the remaining part of the 28. And I received word from Miami that he had approved the 28 million but had cut the remaining portion. Of the 28, and that I was to see Mr. Morgenthau, who was really controlling the growth of the army and all on account of the debt limit. When I went to see Mr. Morgenthau, I found he didn't want to talk to me about this remaining portion of it. I always think of 9 million. Well, I'll say 9 million. That wasn't it. Apparently, it was 10 million. That had been eliminated by the president. Wouldn't allow us to go before Congress for that. But he was now talking about the 18. Well, I was so shocked with that. These numbers were so minute, in a sense. Our needs were so vast. And the time involved was so long that it was just a puzzle in my mind how in the world we could hold out till we got any of these things. So in this case, when Mr. Morgenthau apprised me of the real situation, I said a little along that line. And he was very much affected. And he asked me if I could come the next morning when he had a free morning. Well, I went over the next morning and I outlined him the whole situation. And he was absolutely appalled when he visualized, grasped the enormity of the problem we had, its terrific cost, and the time which must be consumed before any of it could be realized. So he arranged to see the president after lunch, and he and I went into lunch in the Treasury Department, and he gave orders that we were not to be disturbed. Nevertheless, we were disturbed three times in connection with messages regarding the possible closing of the stock exchange. And we went to see the president, who, it was quite evident, was not desirous of seeing us. The conversation through most of the meeting, in fact all of it for a long time, was between the president and Mr. Morgenthau, and he was getting very little chance to state his case. I rather assumed that the president was staging this rather drastic handling of Mr. Morgenthau for my benefit, because they were old friends, neighbors, The first thing that Mr. Morgenthau took up was the organizing of a civilian group, which later developed into a very impressive organization. Knudsen was head of it at one time. Ed Satinius was the first head of it. And the president, in reply to one phase of this, said that that wasn't necessary at all. He said, "I have Harry Hopkins there in the Department of Commerce. I have you in the Treasury Department, and you are handling most of the War Department matters connected to finance and equipment. And he mentioned somebody else, and I am handling the rest. So there's no necessity for that." Then Mr. Morgenthau got around to the military aspects, military equipment, and the president was exceedingly short with him. Finally, Mr. Morgenthau said, "Well, Mr. President, will you hear General Marshall?" And the president replied, I remember this most distinctly. The president replied, "Well, I know exactly what he would say. There's no necessity for me hearing him at all." Well, it was a desperate situation. I felt that he might be president, but I had certain knowledge I was sure he didn't possess or didn't grasp, and that I thought the whole thing was catastrophic in its possibilities. And this last cut just emphasized that point. So, recalling that a man has a great advantage psychologically when he stands looking down on a fellow, I took advantage, in a sense, of the president's condition. So when he terminated the meeting, I not having had a chance to say anything, I walked over and stood looking down at him. And I said, "Mr. President, may I have 3 minutes? And then in a complete change of mood, in a very gracious fashion, I said, "Of course, General Marshall, of course. Sit down." No, he didn't say sit down either. I said, "Now, first, Mr. Morgenthau spoke to you about this civilian organization to represent all the civil side of these matters. And you said that Hopkins had one part of it, Morgenthau had one part of it, and he himself was having one part of it." And I said, "With all frankness, none of you are supermen. And Mr. Morgenthau has no more chance of managing this thing than a flying. We just had lunch, and he gave orders he was not to be interrupted. He was interrupted 3 times by the matter of the closing of the stock exchange. He can't possibly grasp all these things. He was trying to get the straight of the enormity of our situation regarding military preparedness, and he wasn't even allowed to do that." I said, "If you don't do something like that, and do it right away, and really do it today, I don't know what's going to happen to this country." Now, I said, as to the military part, I just came here in the first place about a cut of something that had previously been approved with the budget and been turned down in Congress of a very small sum of money. Seems large just these days, but it's eventually going to be considered a very small sum. I said, "I don't know quite how to express myself about this to the President of the United States, but I'll say this, that you've got to do something, and you've got to do it today." And I went out of the room with $79 billion. And 3 weeks later, we got $100 billion appropriation between the Navy and ourselves, and $50 billion or something like that of the hundred.
Is that billion or
Attorney
million?
General's part.
Billion or million?
Hmm? Billions. Billions. He was cutting me on 18 millions, and we came out of there with billions. And when he came back 3 weeks later, oh, incidentally, he'd spoken about Congress. I said, "I know you can get them to accept it. They can't evade it." And I said, "If you'll allow me, I can help in that, and I'll send over a draft of the message." And I made the first draft of the message. I don't remember how much it changed it. But he had a fashion of changing things, because he had complete confidence in his extraordinary ability in that respect, and he just wouldn't accept anything without changing it. Later on, he accepted the whole damn business I gave him in a way that really frightened me, because he always had a wider point of view of necessity than I did, and I was always loath to accept this opportunity. That's what Mr. Truman always frightened me about. I could get him to prove anything. But I knew enough to know that I didn't have the whole field.
But Mr. Truman had complete faith in you, didn't he? Mr. Truman always had complete faith in
you. Well, he just accepted. Mm-hmm. And I was afraid of that because there were, while I felt that way, there were other facets of the affair that I might not understand. Anyway, 3 weeks later, had occurred the fall of France. And Morgenthau called me up and told me that the manufacturers, the industry now, would bid on these things, which they'd refused to do before because they were completely uncertain as to what the labor situation was going to be. The administration left them gasping about that, and they wouldn't risk the stockholders' money. Mm. Now it was the country, and they were perfectly willing to take hazards that they wouldn't accept before at all. So therefore, Mr. Morgenthau called me up and told me he could now place contracts for airplane engines, which is what we lacked. And so we drummed up a new appropriation, which we got, I've forgotten, we got pretty near 800 million. I don't remember what the Navy got. And which included this great air increase in materiel.
But the big roadblock, the big block had been burst before the fall of France, actually, as a result of this conference. I say the big block had been knocked down even before the fall of France as a result of that conference.
Yes, yes. This second one was just 3 weeks later. And the president was furious. He didn't like this first one, you see. But it went through and it passed right away. And I don't even remember a budget, certainly not a prolonged budget hearing on it. They were getting all restless by that time. And he said, I've just sent a message to Congress 3 weeks ago. What will they think of me? Well, I said, Mr. President, the world has changed since 3 weeks ago. Well, what's more to the point, the industry will accept contracts now that it didn't dare accept before. And I'm certain you'll have no trouble whatever. And then some fool came up with a statement that if you'd let me handle it, I could put it right over. And of course, that just infuriated him. Matter of fact, that was true for this reason. In the first place, they were certain I had no ulterior motive. In the next place, they'd begun to trust my judgment. But most important of all was that if Republicans could assure their constituency that they were doing it on my suggestion, and not on Mr. Roosevelt's suggestion, they could go ahead and back the thing. But he had such enemies that otherwise the members of Congress didn't dare seem to line up with him. And that was true of certain Democrats who were getting pretty bitter.
And of course, the election was coming up that fall.
How's that?
The election was coming up that
fall,
and they wanted to stand clear of anything that would help him.
Well, anyway, that was the great breach in getting our money started. I always had a firm feeling, a tragic feeling, that if we could have done that in the fall of 39, we'd have shortened the war at least a year and probably much longer. We would have saved hundreds of billions and 100,000 casualties.
Well, you might have avoided Pearl Harbor altogether because you'd have had all sorts of warning systems and patrols that you didn't have.
Well, that was so much a mismanagement that God knows whether I don't know where you got them. Is this of any value to you?
This is magnificent. You see, this sort of thing is material we can't get out of the record because it's something that you and the president knew and Harry Hopkins. You're the only one left on the American side who knows any of this story. And the president didn't put his down, and Hopkins didn't put all of his down.
No, Hopkins, what Hopkins really did was quite remarkable. All those general staff, combined chiefs of staff, U.S. chiefs of staff records are supposed to be highly confidential. Well, he had to make himself, in a large measure, the president's, reporting to the president what was happening. And then he filed the darn things in his file.
Yeah.
So he has them all available, whereas, in a sense, they weren't supposed to be available at all to anyone.
Yes, I know he had a copy, for example, of all those files of Potsdam and Yalta and so on. Mm-hmm. When you turned your copy over to us, we have your set. I used your set in writing on the my book. Now, with number four.
What is your view as to the time we should occupy Germany? I don't recall.
But in 43, it would not have been a 10 years. You wouldn't have dreamed of 10 years, would you?
Well, I don't know if we're going to feed them out of soup kitchens all the time. It would take about
10 years.
Garden for a long time. I don't know just what my feeling was. I shared in a measure the president's fears about France.
But you had some
and it was stirred up in a large measure by De Gaulle.
You had very good friends, though, in France, below his level.
Oh, yes, very good friends. He had already begun to do things, you see, that in relation to who was that fellow they sent to over to Asia there and that fighting in Indochina?
Delotte.
Well, I see, I ran into Delotte down in southern France when he had replaced Juin. And I was much outraged by him. Later, we got into an impasse there where he gave de Gaulle's orders interfering with the conduct of the armies which were under command of Clark in Italy, in that northwestern section there. But he was attacking, who is it? I started to say Devlin, wasn't Devlin. Who's
Devers?
Devers. He was attacking Devers. Was Devers in command of that landing?
Six. He commanded six army.
No, it was
Truscott.
Hmm?
Truscott had the landing.
Truscott. He was criticizing Truscott very much for that he wasn't getting the proper amount of supplies and all coming up the trail towards the Vosges. And the truth was, they were no supplies to get. A division is supposed to have 900 tons a day, I think, and they were cut down to Patton's only getting 300 tons. And all action had ceased on the front because we couldn't get supplies to them, particularly gasoline. And on top of that, Delatte was making this a triumphant march, and they were delaying at villages after villages and cities. And they were not up to the place, you know. And he was very bitterly critical of Truscott in front of the French reporters.
Uh-huh.
And this bird from Philadelphia, who is now over in Formosa, was ambassador to Russia at one time. Bastards of France.
The Biddle over there?
Huh?
That Biddle?
Biddle?
That's not Biddle.
No, no, he's a Philadelphian.
Oh, Bullitt.
Bullitt. Bullitt was a major with him. And is doing nothing but playing up Bullitt on the bootleg in the French. And I just terminated the proceedings. Right in front of the French reporters and American reporters. And I restrained myself from not flowing off his head. But I just stopped the thing right where it was and walked out. So when they proposed him to have the ground command in NATO, and I was in Paris with the United Nations, he came to see me to see if I was opposed to him because of the business down in northwestern Italy, where he had orders from de Gaulle, who had no right to give him any orders at all because he was interfering with command. And I said, no, Delotte, I understood that. It was completely irregular, and he had no authority to do that. But your position was quite difficult, and I accepted that. But I said, when it comes to the other thing, what you were guilty of when I first saw you in France, you have none of the qualities at all for an Allied commander. I said, that is the most outrageous business of yours. I restrained myself very, very carefully from just tearing you down to the ground. Because what you did was the most culpable performance for a man that had any idea of how Allied forces must get along. And I said, in the next place, you didn't have a leg to stand on. You celebrated all the way up the road. You were late on every damn thing.
Yeah.
And there wasn't anything to divide. And you are critical of Truscott, who's a fighter and not a talker.
Yeah.
So I said, I'm not going to oppose you on this at all, because I said, as a matter of fact, that command doesn't amount to much right now. It will, but it doesn't right now. You are no man to command any Allied thing, because you are political.
Yeah.
Actually, he's a good fighter. And did a good job out there in Indochina.
Yes.
Or where he died as a result of it. But that performance there was terrible. And right in front of all these reporters. Unfortunately, they didn't bring it up at all.
Is that right?
I think they spared me, because I was so outraged by it. I was outraged at my people. I was outraged at Devers for standing there letting it go on. No, Truscott, yeah. I was outraged at him. Sympathetic with him, of course, because he was being attacked. But what's his name? Bullitt. Didn't say a damn word. He just stood there and smirked. God knows what he told the reporter. But I was out with him right then. He was just... I don't know where we are or what we're doing.
You were talking about number five. Now, you've answered six earlier, and I think most of seven. You answered six a while ago, and seven is pretty much what you've told me also.
If he said we ought to have Berlin, he was just talking. Of course they'd like to have Berlin complete.
Yeah.
All those boundaries, I was so absorbed in the battle to get the French some representation, particularly in Berlin, where we had to give up part of our holdings to France. And the Russians wouldn't make any compromise on that at all. What do they mean here? After Marshall explained the case against going into the Balkans, the president said that the Russians were only 60 miles from the Polish border, 40 from Bessarabia, and might shortly enter Russia.
That's misprint. That's my fault. Enter Poland.
Oh, I see. I don't know about question 8. I don't know about question 9 either. So many of these things seem to go to some chance remark.
Mm-hmm.
You could well understand some fellow might turn away there at the table and say, God damn these Russians anyway. Well, you say that reflects complete opposition to the whole thing. We probably said somewhat similar things about the British at times, and I know they did about us. So they're not the basis of historical evidence. They are part of the historical atmosphere,
certainly,
of the times. For example, I was very much opposed to receiving decorations. I thought during the war, for me to receive any decorations while the our men were in the jungles of New Guinea and the islands in the Pacific, especially, or anywhere where there was heavy fighting, it wouldn't appear at all well for me to be